Since you more than doubled the pledge drive goal for On Your Money, we will double our thank you with another all questions answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, thanking you for your support and welcoming your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at onyourmoney@wpr.org. There we go. I finally figured out what I was doing. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
You know, during this Tuesday morning broadcast of On Your Money, we had a goal during the pledge drive of 230 pledges, which is a lot. But this show is repeated on Tuesday night at 9, and it's repeated on Sunday morning at 7. And we had 721 people who made pledges during On Your Money in during the broadcasts last month, and that shattered the old record. So, Kevin, you want to shatter the thank yous here.
Wow, is all I can say. And thank you very much. Again, let's be clear. There were actually 721 pledges. 500 of those were my friends, family, and me. So let's be clear about this for semantics. Yes, we are going to say thank you again because we're very appreciative of not only listening but also pledging. And so we are going to spent the entire hour last week answering all questions sent in via fax, email, call, carrier pigeon. We're trying to get telepathic questions answered, but if you're just driving down the road thinking about something, we can't quite hear you yet, so please use a more conventional method.
Yeah, we got a lot of emails in last week's broadcast that we'll use some of them this week. Let's start with one from Larry, who said, last week Kevin mentioned that retirement money should be taken from one's pre-tax retirement accounts, like IRAs and 401ks, before withdrawing from one's taxed savings. Why is that the correct withdrawal sequence?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was waiting for the false praise.
He didn't have any.
He had no false praise, yet his question got through. We'll have to speak with quality control about that. It's due to the progressive nature of the income tax rates. Typically, as we earn income or receive it during the year, we generally pay little or nothing on the first tens of thousands of dollars, depending on our filing status. It's only once we get over a certain figure where we get into the 25 to over 40% federal income tax bracket. So the notion is that you want to pay a little bit every single year, get the income that you need so that you don't pay a lot more later down the road.
Why might a retiree pay more later?
Two reasons. They might have a bigger tax bill down the road if they don't plan appropriately. First of all, if money is in a tax-sheltered account like an IRA or a 401k, and if you have a significant portion of your assets in those types of accounts, you will have a required minimum distribution that occurs after you turn 70 and a half, and that's every single year until either you or the account balance is gone. And technically, that's taxable income. And if you don't take out some now, you might have to take out a lot later, according to the law, and then pay a lot more in taxes down the road as well. Another thing that's common is people in their 50s or 60s don't necessarily need the money in their IRA right now, so they don't take it out, but they do need it in an emergency, and they need to pull it all out or a bunch of it out, and they can't tax plan with it, and so they end up taking a big lump sum out that is taxed at the highest possible level.
Well, so what is the order that generally should be used to fund retirement?
You should start with any earnings that you have. If you're fortunate enough to have a little bit of a part-time income in retirement, obviously you want to deal with that, but then your pension, then your Social Security, and then any IRA or 401k withdrawals up to the 15% federal tax bracket ceiling. Then after that, if you still need money on which to live or for an emergency, you want to pull it out of savings, then after you've exhausted your savings, you may want to move on to a home equity line of credit. And finally, a Roth IRA could be tapped as well. But again, even the Roth IRA distributions generally are not going to add to your tax bill.
I don't know if I understand the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket.
Sure. As we mentioned, the tax brackets are progressive, meaning the rates go higher as your income goes up, but they don't act retroactively, meaning that it's only certain amounts of income are taxed at a certain rate, and then certain amounts of income above that level are taxed at a certain rate, et cetera. So for 2014, the number is determined on what's on line 43 of your 1040 form, and it's $73,800 is the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket, and it's about half that for single filers. Below that, it's going to be taxed at 15% or less at a federal level, and above that $73,800 level for married couples filing jointly, again, it could be taxed at 25 to over 40%.
Okay, I get it. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, call 1-800-642-1234 or send your email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Steve in Green Bay is with us first. Hello, Steve.
Hello there. I have a question about retirement. I'm going to retire next year, and I have the option, obviously, of taking the pension at a monthly payment or a lump sum, or I can take that and go like 75% lump sum, 25% pension, or the other way around, down to 50 to 25, whatever. I'm just looking at the best way to look at this, and I was watching how the market's working these days, and it's been pretty good. I'm considering just a lump sum and using that as a portion of that to retire with, along with my other the other assets I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made a good point about the other assets. You do have other liquid assets set aside that you could draw from if you needed to?
Yeah, well, it would be like I have a military pension and Social Security and a 401k besides my pension.
Okay. You already have two forms of income in retirement, which, again, are better than none, but are still income streams over which you have very little control over how it is sent to you, and very little control over what is done with the money in the future. And you don't even have the knowledge of it. You can't tell where it's invested. You can't tell what might change down the road. And if you need the money in an emergency, it's difficult to get a Social Security check advance or a military pension advance. You can technically borrow against it, but that's a very bad arrangement. So the pension, Steve, is this from a private company you work for, or is it a state pension?
No, it's a private company I've worked for 39 years.
Okay. I'd love to believe that the company is going to do whatever it possibly can to not only manage your money appropriately while it's in that pension fund, but also do everything it can to make sure you get what's coming to you. My guess is that down the road that could be a problem. And if you don't, I don't want to say trust, but don't have a high degree of confidence that they'll always be able to do this, I'd much rather have you take the lump sum out. Not because I think that, you know, oh, you're going to do better on your own. You very well may. But you have more control over the money when it's in your account. You have more knowledge of where it's invested. You have more flexibility. You can do whatever you want with it. You can buy CDs or treasuries or gold or whatever you want. You can't do that with a pension check. And let's say the 25 years go by and the company is forced with a very difficult decision. They have to either honor their pension obligations or they have to lay off a bunch of employees or not expand into new markets or not pay a dividend or interest payments to the bondholders. The people running the company at that time have a fiduciary obligation to all those other parties, and they're probably going to try to skimp out of the pension payments. And I couldn't blame them for doing so. I'd feel bad for the pension recipients. But for those reasons, I'd much rather have you take the lump sum, roll it over into a qualified IRA, and then invest it however you see fit.
All right, Steve? Oh, I guess it's all right because he hung up.
Silence is consent.
Bob in Blue Mounds is with us now. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask about Kevin's golden plan for retirement. Needing 300 months, I think, if you retire at, I believe it's age 60. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's as a rule of thumb, I like to see people have at least 200 and hopefully 300 times their net monthly expenses when they retire, meaning net after any pension or Social Security payments. If you plan on spending, say, $5,000 a month and you're going to get $2,000 a month from Social Security, that leaves $3,000 that needs to be covered. And ideally, you should have at least $600,000 and hopefully $900,000 to cover that gap for your retirement.
At age 60 or?
Early 60s, usually. Usually most people have about a 25-year retirement based on their life, retiring in their early to mid-60s and passing away in their early to mid-80s.
Yeah. So is that, I mean, when planning between those numbers, which year you should retire, let's say you're 60, so you do the 300 months, that puts you at 85 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if you, you know, what happens at that point? Let's say you followed Kevin's plan. Now you're 85. You've run out of funds. You still have the $1,000 or $2,000 coming in from Social Security, but beyond that, you don't have anything. You're sitting there in a retirement home.
Boy, Kevin's going to be in trouble.
No, they can just come and live with me. I'll take care of you as long as it takes, Bob. I gave you the advice, you followed it. It didn't work out as hoped, and so we have plenty of room at our place. I think that's probably unlikely, and the reason being is that things will change, obviously, from the time in your 60s until you're in your 80s or so. But obviously more money is better. But even working an extra year or two in your early 60s really doesn't add a lot of benefit to you. That taking out, say, 1/300th of your assets at age 62 is about a 3% rate of return, a little over that, or 3% withdrawal rate, I should say. And that's a fairly sustainable rate in most situations. And one way to look at that is say, well, if you bury your money in a hole in the ground and you pull it out, say, 1/300th every single month, that's going to last 25 years and at the same rate. And the chances are you're not going to bury it in the hole in the ground. You're going to do something that earns a little bit of return. It could be very safe and maybe earn 1% or 2%, or you could take a much more risk and try to earn, say, 4% to 6% per year. But you are going to earn some rate of return, and Social Security will be raised, hopefully, for inflation over that time. And finally, Bob, you probably have a home that you own, I would assume?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, eventually that can and maybe should be monetized in the form of selling it or a reverse mortgage. And if you move to an apartment or assisted living facility or a nursing home, that's one more mm-hmm. store of wealth that could do it. And when you run the numbers, what you do find is, like I said, it's great to work another year if you can stand it, if you have the opportunity to work. But working one more year and earning one more year, when spreading that extra net income out over 25 or 30 year retirement, it usually doesn't make very much difference. It's usually just the margin of error for rates of return and emergency spending. So work as long as you can, but don't feel that extra year or two is really going to make that big of a difference for better or for worse.
Thanks, Bob, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is a bonus all questions answered edition of On Your Money. If you have a personal finance question that you'd like to run by Kevin, call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Give me some money.
Well, since you gave Wisconsin Public Radio so much money, you more than doubled the pledge drive goal for On Your Money. We are doubling our thank you with this extra all questions answered edition of On Your Money. The entire hour devoted to your questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And to Ann in Milwaukee, we go next. Hello, Ann.
Good morning. I'm working with a financial planner who recommended an investment through Hanlon Investments because it had great management, solid ROI, a good return, and it was based on a goal of certainly preserving capital, but with some growth. I'm getting close to retirement. And I'm wondering, how long do you wait to give the investment chance to prove itself? Because so far it's been about a year, and I think I've paid more in fees than I've seen in an investment. Mm-hmm. So I'm just seeing an investment growth. So I'm curious, you know, again, it's been a year. How long do you wait to give a chance to prove itself?
Well, the year is a pretty short time, especially in these times. These have been some very weird years because of the Federal Reserve's involvement with investment markets and influence on investment markets. And yes, it is troubling to pay more in fees than you get in return. And keep in mind, if the investment has some chance of growth, it also has some chance of loss. And therefore, you could even be in a position, Ann, where the invest you could pay all those fees and you could actually lose money on it as well. So I'm not familiar with the investment manager. But a year is probably a time frame where I would say I wouldn't judge it just by the 12 months, for better or for worse. Some people say, gosh, I lucked out. I got into something just before it went up 20%. It's a great investment. That may be true, but it could also go down 30% in the next year afterwards. So I would want to give it at least 5 years or so. I would also make sure, though, do you have other assets set up other than just with this particular investment strategy?
Yes, I do. I've got others, and they're performing pretty well. That's why when I look at this one, it's like, so maybe this isn't such a good deal. But again, the goal really is to preserve some of that money, too, and it hasn't lost enough that I would be starting to look at it in panic. But I'm just thinking, how long do you really give it? So that's been helpful information.
Sure, and I'll say this, too, Ann. Sometimes, especially if whoever suggested it to you, is aware of your other investments, if they've done well and this one hasn't, that could mean that it's you have a very well-diversified portfolio and the person took your other assets into account when deciding how to allocate this particular strategy. I can't guarantee that, but that's a possibility as well. And that's really what you want, especially when you are nearing retirement. And in these markets, it can be very anxiety-inducing. So I do agree with you that I'd like to have you have a lot of money set aside that isn't going to go up very much but isn't going to go down very much. So I hope you can reach that goal.
I do, too. Thank you, Ann, for the call. Helen in Arborvitae is with us now. Hello, Helen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a question about investing many years ago in the early 80s for our grandson, who was just a little kid. He's 42 years old now. And we had it in our name all those years. We had it switched over in 2013 into his name, and it turned out that it was worth about $40,000 now. And he needed it badly, and so I was grateful that we did it. And now I have learned that there's something called a gift tax.
Mm.
And I looked it up on the Internet, and it's the part that I fill out, I guess, is at least 6 pages long, and none of it seems to have much to do with this gift that we gave our grandson. Tell me what I should be doing next, please.
Sure. When you set up the account, Helen, did you set it up with his Social Security number way back when, or was it just something you kind of earmarked for him?
Yes, it was. It was in our names, my
okay.
husband and were his grandparents.
Okay. And you actually had to transfer the title of the account from you to him when you gave him the money last year, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Technically, you do. The good news is you're not going to owe any money if you file this properly, or not very much at all. Anyone can give anyone else up to $14,000 per year with no gift tax implications. So technically, you and your husband could each give your grandson $14,000 and for a total of $28,000 with no gift tax implications. However, that doesn't sound like what happened. So then what you have to do is file a gift tax return. I think it's Form 709 if you go to irs.gov and check Form 709. You have to file the gift tax return, but I doubt that you will owe anything in gift tax liability because there's a gift tax exemption amount, a lifetime one, that's several million dollars that you can give that money above and beyond the $14,000 annual amount. And if you do file the gift tax return properly, you shouldn't owe any gift tax on that. Are you doing your own taxes or are you having someone help you with it?
No, well, I usually do our own, but at the senior center, they have someone to help if you run into something like this.
Okay. And that's a very nice program. Your issue might be more complex than what a volunteer would like to help you with. And so what I'd recommend is you do try to find a CPA or tax preparer in your area who can help you with this, just to make sure it's done properly and to make sure that you don't have any tax liability at all. But again, keep in mind that if it is done properly, you won't owe any gift tax as long as you file everything on time.
Thank you very much.
Good luck, Helen.
Yeah, good luck, Helen. What a nice grandmother. Grandson should pay if there is any
yes.
tax.
Yes, he should. He's old enough now, middle age practically.
What a nice grandma. Art in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Art. Hello,
hi,
Art.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Art.
Hi. So I have some mutual funds that we held for maybe 25 years or more. Always totally reinvested any, yields. Sold some of that. And not having much luck from either the fund or a brokerage that had it in their account for a while, getting cost basis information. So is there any alternative other than me trying to find the last 25 years of year-end statements and calculate it myself? Is there any, public database or something where you can track the yield and the value of a fund over a couple of decades?
And you did contact the fund?
Contacted the fund, contacted the brokerage. They said, well, we changed this fund to that name and that name, and then we put it in a brokerage and took it out. And here's a few years of information, but not much. And
okay. Well, the law says that if you can't find an accurate cost basis for an asset sale, and I take it you've sold this already or not?
Yeah, it sold last year, but I might sell some more this year too.
Okay, and there are three issues here. One is the actual tracking of the cost basis. The other is the fact that the funds may have changed a name, which makes it more difficult to track. And the third one is that you've purchased and sold shares at the almost simultaneously, or at least during the 25 years. Correct?
Well, purchased 25 years ago, sold last year.
Right, but every time you've had a dividend that's been reinvested in the fund, which has happened, that's counted as a purchase. That's if you get a $100 dividend from the fund and buy more shares, in the eyes of the IRS, that's like you sent the fund $100 and bought shares with it, which again is great for growth of an investment, et cetera, but it's terrible for tax basis. Art, can you give me a rough idea of what the dollar amount of the proceeds of these mutual funds were?
Oh, maybe $30,000 bucks.
Okay.
$30,000.
The bad news is the law says that if you cannot come up with an accurate cost basis for these funds, the number you have to use is zero, and all $30,000 become a realized capital gain. But there is hope. First of all, even if you were to do that, most of those gains would be long-term capital gains, which, depending on your tax bracket, are going to be taxed as little as 0% at the federal level and as much as maybe 15% or so. But you'd want to avoid that if you can, because a lot of the shares were not purchased at zero at a much higher price. So what I would do is try to get year-end statements, try to assemble a spreadsheet where you run down each purchase and each transaction and come up with a cost basis that is as factual as it possibly can be, and then use that number as the basis reporting your cost basis and then your gain, and then pay the taxes. And the worst thing that can happen in that situation is you get audited by the IRS. The IRS says, how did you come up with this? You present them with a reasonable estimate of how you did it. They may say, sorry, that doesn't work. But what's more likely, they say, okay, you've done your best. You've done your homework. You've tried to do this. And therefore, the dollar amount that you've declared, you don't look like you're trying to avoid any taxes, and we can't prove otherwise. So we're going to say that it's fair enough. And it's just a matter of saying, what's the time spent putting that information together worth to go ahead and put it all together. It's a good lesson for other listeners out there, though. If you do have mutual funds held outside of retirement accounts like IRAs or 401ks, you're probably better in the long run taking those distributions every single year in cash and just using it to pile up money and then maybe buying shares individually with that fund down the road, especially if you can still do it without a sales charge, because you really create a tax nightmare if and when you go to sell the shares.
Noted. Thanks very much, Art, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, who is answering your questions about mutual funds, retirement, student loans, credit card debt, anything that is on your mind today regarding your personal finances. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, let's go to a question now from Rick, who says that he and his wife are paying their daughter's student loans off, and they're wondering if they can deduct the interest.
Maybe, maybe not. It depends on the kind of loan. There's a legal requirement to be able to deduct interest on a student loan. You have to be legally obligated to pay the loan under the letter of the agreement with the lender. And the daughter, this can be true if the daughter were a dependent of them at the time the loans were taken out. It's definitely true if they were actually parent loans and they meet the other criteria for it. But even if they can't get it under this criteria, there are still a couple of ways they could deduct interest on this borrowed amount.
So how might Rick and his wife go about that?
One way I might, kind of a backdoor way to go about it that I might suggest is to refinance a mortgage and use the proceeds from the mortgage or a home equity line of credit or a home equity loan to actually pay off the student loans. And then the future interest on that loan will be tax deductible as long as they itemize and exceed the standard deduction amount. The interest rate may be lower, the term may be longer and more flexible than what they can get on the student loans as well. But by doing so, they may be risking any home equity they have accumulated. Another way that they can do that and still try to get some of the money back is to then write a new loan agreement with the daughter, and hopefully she can repay them somewhere down the road.
Yeah, we hope so. Besides refinancing, anything else they can do?
They may want to actually give some money to the daughter, and she makes the loan payment, so the loan gets paid off. And if the loan is in her name and she weren't a dependent at the time the student loan were taken out, she may be able to deduct the interest down the road. And in many cases, she doesn't even have to itemize to still be able to deduct it.
Sounds good. Let's go to the phones and go to Ann in northern Wisconsin. Hello, Ann.
Yes, I think part of my question may have been answered possibly by a previous caller. But in any case, I have IRAs in CDs in the local bank, and then I have mutual funds. And I wondered at what, I know at 70 and a half you have to start taking money out. How do I go about doing, is it like I have to take everything I put in out by 70 and a half, or do I just need to start here and there taking funds out of my IRAs?
It's really a weird arrangement. First of all, you have to begin taking money out of retirement accounts by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. And then, let's say you were to wait that long to do it, then you have to take another withdrawal out before the end of that same calendar year. So you can either take it out the year you turn 70 and a half, or you can take two withdrawals out the subsequent year, and it's usually twice as much if you were to, than what you were going to take out the previous year. And then you have to take out a dollar amount every single year that's based on the balance of all of your retirement accounts on the previous December 31st. This is your required minimum distribution. The good news, though, is that you generally can take all the money required to be pulled out of the account from one account if you'd like. Let's say you like the CDs, you don't want to disturb them, you'd rather take it out of the mutual funds. You can do that as long as you take out the amount, and you're either your tax preparer or a financial advisor should be able to figure out how much you're supposed to take out if you give them all the information, or the IRS has a calculator at irs.gov that you can use to figure out what to take out. But make sure you take that out each year in, because if you don't, the money that you were supposed to withdraw and didn't is subject to a 50% excise tax, and then you still owe income taxes on it as well. So you basically end up losing about two-thirds of whatever you were supposed to take out.
So I need to total up what the value was when I took it out, or what it is now?
The value is as of December 31st of the previous year. So let's say it's worth $100,000, and you go to the IRS calculator, and they say, hey, you have to take 3% of this dollar out, of this dollar amount out before the end of the year. You take $3,000 out, and that's enough. And it can come from any of the accounts. You don't have to allot it proportionally.
Okay. And then is just one more quick question. For tax purposes, do I need to know the year? I took all of these different ones out since 1986 on up now. I have kept record more recently, but previously I didn't have the best record keeping. So mm-hmm. does it matter the year that I took it out?
Nope. As long as they're all pre-tax or tax-deductible IRA contributions and there aren't any after-tax IRAs in there, you should be fine. You don't have to remember those things.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, and thanks for that question. I took notes on that myself. Let's go to Dave in Caledonia. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. My question is, what do you do to protect yourself against the next possible 2008 meltdown?
Well, there, in terms of meltdown, if you mean things going down in value, that not only can happen again, but it will. We don't know when. We don't know how long it will last. We don't know what degree it will be. But if you have stocks, you should expect to lose in any given year 30 to 40% of the value. And then if you can still stomach that probability and possibility, you should be okay and you will get likely a greater long-term return down the road. If not, probably the best thing to do is put the money in a bank or credit union, keep it federally insured if you possibly can. The good news about that, that's about as safe as you can get when it comes to paper investments. The bad news is right now a lot of other people feel like you do and don't want to take any risk with their money. Therefore, interest rates on these types of investments are very low because there's such a high demand for it. So you have a choice between suffering through another meltdown or not making anything on your investments to speak of, and it's you know, each person's choice and needs are different. I can't say what's better for you, Dave. It just depends on what your bigger fear is, not making anything or losing a lot in one particular year.
Maybe go half and half with each way. You know,
That's not the worst idea in the world, in part because you'll know that if things do go down a lot, you say, well, I've still got some money I can live off of, and who knows, maybe you can reinvest again at lower prices from the money that you preserved.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. And this is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money, our way of saying thank you again for more than doubling the targeted number of pledges that we had as our goal during the recent winter pledge drive. So what are your questions for Kevin? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Make that On Your Money at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network. Money, honey. Money, honey. Money, honey. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, welcoming your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from Andrew who says, I have about $9,000 of debt on 5 credit cards with interest of up to 24%. Wow. So what is the best way to consolidate that and get out of debt? Many thanks, Kevin.
Well, if you have decent credit, Andrew, you may be able to actually play all those credit card issuers against each other by contacting each one, explaining your situation. They probably already know it because they have access to your credit report. Tell them you're thinking about consolidating and you'd like to move to whichever card provider gives you the best offer in terms of fees and in terms of interest rate. But make sure you get the information in writing. A lot of times when card companies send these offers out unsolicited to people, they say, well, yeah, we'll give you 0% for the next year, but it's subject to credit approval. And then if you don't have great credit, once you actually check in on it, you find out that the interest rate may actually be higher on the new card than you're currently paying on the old one.
Mm-hmm. So what if they can't help him?
I would visit a local bank or better yet a credit union and just explain your situation and say, I'm wondering if it were possible to get a personal loan, and the interest rate on that might be 8 to 10% or so. You might be able to spread it out over a longer term so that you can make a lower payment on it, but they may require as part of the agreement that you cancel all of these credit cards so that you don't charge it back up again after they lend you the money to pay them off.
Yeah, and if no one will help Andrew consolidate?
A couple simple strategies. He can pay this balance off in about a year at $800 per month. And usually if someone is struggling to pay off a balance like this, it's tough for them to cut expenses, so they need to try to increase income. If you can cut $400 of expenses and take a part-time job 10 hours per week at $9 an hour, that should pay the loan off within a year, or the credit cards, if you will. And then in the meantime, I would love to see him freeze the credit cards, not only call the provider and say, look, I don't want to be able to use these anymore, put a cap on what I'm doing with it voluntarily, and then literally freeze them, put the plastic in a jar with water, screw the lid on, and then put them in the freezer so that you have to think about getting access to the card before you use it again.
Yeah, that would make it a little harder to get to. Yeah, sounds good. Let's go next to Pam in Milwaukee. Hello, Pam.
Hello. I have a question regarding long-term care insurance. I recently retired and have the ability to continue paying what used to be paid by my employer, but continue paying that on my own. It's approximately $73 a month. And at one time, I believe I heard you comment about your net worth being an indicator of whether you need to continue this insurance or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it usually applies more to people who are considering purchasing it for the first time. Generally, if you have less than $200,000 in net worth, it's probably not something you should be spending your money on. If you have more than $2 million in net worth, you can probably self-insure any long-term care expenses out of your own pocket. And I take it by your chuckle, Pam, that you have net worth substantially more than $2 million.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. I will say this. I'm sorry. Tell me again once more. What's the premium cost?
$72.60, to be precise.
Okay. Even if it's a horrible policy, that's a great rate. So if you can afford to do it, I would definitely have you. Were you to go out and try to find a standard policy right now, you could probably expect to pay somewhere around $250 to $300 per month. And again, that might be a little better policy, but it's a lot more money. So I would just as soon have you keep this as long as you can.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Pam. Lynn in Racine is with us now. Hello, Lynn.
Good morning. It's wonderful to talk to both of you.
Hi, Lynn.
This is the situation. My mother has an annuity, one for herself, and then she set up annuities for each of her grandchildren. I want to, and she doesn't have to annuitize her annuity. That's an interesting story. But anyway, what are the tax implications for the grandchildren when they receive those annuities after she has passed? And if it would be better to try to do something with them now instead?
How long ago did she set the accounts up?
About 20 years.
20 years ago. By the way, Lynn, I'm about the only person on the planet who thinks that not having to annuitize an annuity is actually an interesting story. So I won't bore the listeners with that. But I actually am interested in it, and at some point we'll go over that. And who knows, maybe make it into a novel and a movie with some sequels.
We'll devote next week to
that. Understand, my mother will be 96 on the 1st of May.
Well, good for her. She beat all the tables and odds the insurance company set for her.
And she quit smoking last year. Back to the annuity.
Actually, if there's anyone who should enjoy the full, rich tobacco pleasure of a cigarette, it's someone who makes it to 96 years old. But good for her. I like her optimism. Do the annuities set up for the grandchildren have a substantial gain? Like, is the value substantial? Higher than what she put in?
The value, it's probably four times what the original amount was.
And were these set up in the kids' names and now they're owned by the kids? With their social security numbers. Well, for better or for worse, they can leave it in there if they want, but they're only delaying a problem, and especially because as people grow older, they tend to make more money and they tend to then be in higher tax brackets. So you might want to look at, if your mother's okay with it, you might want to look at having them pull the money out and pay the taxes on it. They're going to have to pay taxes on all of the earnings first, and then once they get to the principal portion of it, the original investment amount, there will be no taxes on that whatsoever. Now, if you were to suggest that to your mother, what would she likely say?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. She has some dementia, so mm-hmm. I handle all of her finances. I could probably talk her into it.
Sure. And could your kids use the money?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, then all that's all the more reason to do it. And it's a good thing to note if you are trying to cajole your mother into going along with this is that, you know, you give $10,000 to a 20-year-old, that's worth way more to that person than giving them $100,000 when they're 60 years old and $1 million when they're 80 years old. And so any little bit amount that they can use, and you may even want to say, I'll tell you what, Mom, if you're okay with this, we're going to go ahead and do this. And the kids are going to then start ramping up their contributions to IRAs or 401ks so that they can then not only still save some of the money for the long term and get in good habits, but they can use that to offset the taxes on the distributions of the annuity by putting some of their income into a tax-deferred account if they have that option.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you very much, Lynn. And your mom rocks. we should start a special segment, Kevin. Annuitize your annuity.
Oh, gosh. Well, there aren't enough. We're only on 3 hours a week as it is. I think we'd have to probably take another 3 hours of the schedule to get through all that.
Well, if you have a question about an annuity or anything else, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. There I go again. Send that email to onyourmoney@WPR.org. Dan sent an email. Dan has done some extensive work on deciding when to take Social Security, and he found some fault with the common notion that one should always wait to take Social Security. And he wants to know where you stand on this issue, Kevin.
Well, I have an uncommon notion. I generally lean towards taking it sooner rather than later. Based on pure math, though, Dan probably has already figured out it depends on two factors. One, how long you're going to live. Usually the break-even age is about 79 or 80, meaning that if you live to that age, it's usually better off to wait to take Social Security, no matter what age you're currently at right now. And it also depends on how much you're going to make on the investments that you might otherwise have to tap if you don't take Social Security. If you're going to live a long time and you're not going to make much money on your liquid assets, then maybe it is better to wait to take Social Security and spend your cash. But that should not be the only factor, nor should it even be the primary factor.
So what other factors should Dan consider?
The psychology and more about psychology and less about math, actually. When people retire, they give up this paycheck that they've relied on for 4 decades in most cases, mm-hmm. to pay the bills and to eat and to do all the other things we need to live. The Social Security check replaces that lost paycheck. And as that Social Security check comes in every single month, we're hardwired to look for that check, to use it to help balance our checkbook and to cover expenses and know that, hey, if we just got a check today, 30 days from now, we're going to get another one. And it's very difficult for people to watch their savings go down, especially if they're spending that money go down right after retirement while they're waiting for this, you know, two in the bush kind of a check at some point down the road. So usually as people are making the transition, if they can afford to do it, it's better off to take the Social Security check sooner rather than draw down from savings.
Yeah. Well, what about the investment return on his money?
Yeah, and that's another thing right now. You're stuck between a stock market that's near an all-time high and interest rates that are all-time low. So the higher returns going forward or that we've received in the past are unlikely to be duplicated, so we're unlikely to get high rates that way. And Social Security technically does have a, you know, somewhere from 7 to 8% increase every year, in the sense that every year you wait, you might get a 7% higher check next year. But again, you're 1 year closer to death. And so as long as you live to 80, you beat the averages, but otherwise it's better to take it sooner. And keeping those liquid funds intact, if you will, and using Social Security sooner means you can use those funds for an emergency or to make big purchases that you can't borrow for or to help family members out if they get in trouble down the road, too.
If you have a question that you would like to email, it's onyourmoney@WPR.org. Maybe we will be able to use it in a future On Your Money program. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, like to call in right now. Rich in Evansville is with us. Hi, Rich.
Good morning, folks. I was wondering, I have a thrift savings plan account. I'm a retired federal employee, and it's a type of account whereby if I do take money from that account, it will have to be taxed. So I was wondering, would it be worthwhile to take a little bit out each year and convert it to a Roth? And I suppose it would be the amount of money that would keep me underneath that line 43, $73,000 mark.
This is a new great feature of this show where people ask their own questions and then give the correct answer. Thank you, Tom. Have a good day. All right. No, Rich, it's yes, you're exactly right. It can help balance out the distribution, and you should first of all spend it if you need to spend it, but second of all, any dollar amount that you can roll over to a Roth IRA, and if you can keep it under that 15% federal income tax bracket ceiling, is a great idea to move into a Roth IRA, because not only are you done paying taxes on it, but as of now, there's no mandatory distribution on the Roth IRA at 70.5. So you can leave that money in there as long as you exist.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. A way to answer that question by yourself. Here, I've got to use this comment. Kevin, Marcia on Facebook writes, I have two questions and hope that Kevin will answer them both. If I say he has the second most beautiful eyes in Wisconsin, after her husband, of course. Number one, she wants to know, when is it a good idea to purchase whole life insurance? Is old age, like in one's 80s, a factor? And two, is it a good idea for someone in their 80s to lease a car if that person is not much of a commuter? Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, I take offense at the second most beautiful eyes. I will put my eyes up against anyone's
her
eyes,
husband's.
And I would actually challenge her husband to an eye off. So,
Marcia, post a picture. We'll have a poll.
Yeah, we'll have enough. I don't think it's very rarely is it a good idea to purchase whole life insurance. It's only good, in my opinion, if you are a business owner and you need permanent insurance to help keep liquidity in place if the owner dies, or if it's for an estate tax issue, and that's less likely to happen now than it's ever been. I don't like whole life insurance as an investment. Buying one in the 80s is usually not a good idea, because the life insurance company is so certain that you're going to die that they don't give you a very good death benefit for what you put in there. Now, if you can beat the averages and live a long time, then sometimes it makes sense. But otherwise, at that age, no. And for the person leasing a car and they're not much of a commuter, in their 80s, I would say probably not. I would just as soon have them buy the car, and then the eventual resale value would be higher, because they can say, look, this was driven by a little old lady or a little old man who didn't drive it very much, and so they'll get much back. But the lease can have a lot of fees and expenses in it that can more than make up the difference between trying to just buy one outright.
Thank you so much, Marcia, for the post, the question. We have to get a new picture of you, Kevin, and maybe both of us. You are very handsome in that picture, but you're even more handsome now. When was that picture taken? About 10 years ago or so?
It was my third grade picture, and that's the only one I have that's recent, really. And so I that was my peak attractiveness, so that's what I'm going to stick with forward.
Okay, so what's the website of the week?
Well, the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability, as part of their initiative, came up with a website called moneyasyougrow.org, and it's a neat infographic on 20 things to teach children about money and finance at different stages, and parents and other adults might learn something too. moneyasyougrow.org, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And we plan on being back to normal On Your Money show next week.
Such as it is, yes.
Yeah, all right, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. Thanks very much to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.